This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Wormhole by Richard Phillips, performed by MacLeod Andrews. Chapter 1. Dr. Roger Daubert stepped out of the black Mercedes, almost losing his footing on the icy blacktop. His driver reached out to support him, but he waved the hand away.
"It's okay, Carl. I've got it."
"Black ice is a bitch this morning. Thought we'd slide off the road in that last roundabout." Roger smiled at the bigger man.
"That crossed my mind."
An icy blast of wind forced Roger to duck his head, seeking some protection behind his overcoat's high collar. Damn, it was cold. Of course, what could one expect of March in Switzerland? On the bright side, Meyrin wasn't far outside Geneva. Roger had always loved Geneva. Too bad his schedule wasn't going to allow him to tour more than the airport. Oh well. He'd known his personal life would suffer when he'd agreed to chair PCAST, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Hitching his overcoat more tightly around his neck, Roger hurried out of the wind and into the building that would host today's conference. A review of ongoing repairs on the Large Hadron Collider, or LHC. The most ambitious science project ever undertaken by man occupied a monstrous tunnel 100 meters below ground, just west of Lake Geneva, its 27-kilometer circumference crossing the border between France and Switzerland in multiple spots. The building sat 70 meters above a cavern in which the huge Atlas detector enfolded LHC.1, a beam interaction point where two super-accelerated proton beams collided. At least they did when the whole thing was working.
"Dr. Daubert, I am so pleased you could make it."
Roger turned to see Dr. Louis Dubois, the famed French physicist, who headed the team of Atlas scientists, approaching from across the room. The man had aged since last Roger had seen him, at a conference in New York, long black hair flowing down over his shoulders as if he had just stepped out of a Paris salon, looking more like a 20-something Yanni than a Nobel Prize-winning quantum theorist. Now, he wore it tied back in a greasy ponytail, as if he hadn't bothered to wash it in weeks. His eyes, which seemed to have sunk back into his face, showed a fatigue no sleep could wash away.
"The pleasure is mine, Dr. Dubois. I apologize for my tardiness. The drive took us a bit longer than expected this morning."
Roger nodded toward the reception desk.
"Should I sign in?"
"No need. I have your badge right here. Now, if you'll follow me, the conference is about to begin."
Passing through a doorway, Dr. Dubois led Roger down a short hall and then turned right into a room that was much smaller than what Roger had expected. The conference table seated a dozen, but today only 3 people occupied its chairs. Dr. Dubois, with Roger in tow, now made a grand total of 5. As Roger seated himself, Dr. Dubois moved to the head of the table and began the obligatory introductions.
"Good morning to you all. Although most of you have already met, I will make my way around the table. On my left is Dr. Robert Craig, Chief Scientific Advisor to the United Kingdom's Ministry of Defense."
The stocky red-headed man inclined his head in acknowledgement.
"Continuing in clockwise fashion, Dr. Klaus Gottlieb, Scientific Advisor to the European Commission."
Roger recognized the bald, bird-like visage of the older man from an August meeting in Stockholm. Although he'd only chatted with the scientist briefly, the encounter had felt interminable.
"Next we have Dr. Pierre Boudreau, Senior Astrophysicist for the European Space Agency."
Raising his left eyebrow ever so slightly, Roger glanced across the table at the slender Frenchman. He had known and liked Pierre since they had collaborated on the International Space Station for NASA. The man was brilliant and endowed with an affable personality that could charm a group of locals at a Houston coffee shop as effortlessly as society's elite at a Long Island social. But what was he doing here? For that matter, what was Roger doing here? What had been billed as a conference on the status of LHC repairs was clearly nothing of the sort. Five people? This wasn't enough for a roundtable discussion, much less a conference. And the makeup of the group, two French, one German, a Brit, and an American. Something about the mix didn't seem right for an LHC discussion. The project was a worldwide collaboration. So what was this about?
And on my right is Dr. Roger Dalbert, chairman of the U.S. President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. As for me, I am Dr. Louis Dubois, and I am the senior physicist for the Atlas experiment. Actually, that title is a bit presumptuous, since we have over 2,500 physicists from 37 countries collaborating on this experiment. Let's just say Atlas is my baby, and a very big baby at that.
Roger heard chuckles of approval from the small assemblage. Dr. Dubois paused, then spread his hands, palms up, like a pastor about to call his flock to prayer.
It is by now obvious to you all that this is no conference on the LHC repair schedule. I apologize for the subterfuge, but I am quite certain you will soon understand why we deemed this necessary, given the current situation. One that requires deft handling to avoid undesirable media involvement.
Roger's pulse quickened. Media involvement? Had the CERN scientists made a breakthrough? Had they finally established definitive validation for the physics standard model? But then, why not just present their results? Nothing about this made any sense.
Rather than try to explain why I called you together, let me show you.
Dr. Dubois thumbed a button on the small remote control unit he picked up from the table, bringing the flat panel display on the far wall to life. The screen showed a myriad of colored lines twisting away from a central point, something a child might have produced given a full day with a spirograph. Dr. Dubois moved the mouse pointer on the screen, circling the central point.
This is an Atlas image from testing conducted just prior to the latest system shutdown, early on the morning of the last Friday, November. In fact, it was still Thanksgiving night over in America when this image was captured.
Roger studied the screen. Without a detailed study of the complete data set, he was at a loss to spot anything unusual in the image. Clearly, the extreme energy released in the proton collisions had created a wide range of particles with different charges, spins, and masses, accounting for the assortment of paths that were displayed on the screen.
Now this, Dr. Dubois said, bringing a new image to the display, is Atlas data captured this very morning.
Although the first image had been indicative of an extreme energy event, this latest image showed an order of magnitude increase in particle interactions, so many that it was difficult to discern one path from the other.
Excuse me, Dr. Craig interjected. Were you using the same filter and trigger settings on this last event?
The Atlas instrument settings are unchanged, Dr. Dubois replied.
Something about that statement bothered Roger, and he leaned forward.
But you said this was captured this morning. I didn't realize that you had finished repairing the damaged electromagnets and restoring vacuum to the system. Have you managed to further increase beam energies beyond 10 tera electron volts?
Dr. Dubois leaned back in his chair.
That brings us to the issue at hand. There's really no way to put this except bluntly. There never was any electromagnet damage, or any loss of vacuum in the beam tube. That was merely a cover story issued to the press to allow us time to develop a detailed understanding of the anomaly.
Voices rose in concert, each scientist demanding attention until no single question could be discerned above the noise. Dr. Dubois waited patiently until, at last, the scientists fell silent.
I understand you have questions, But before I yield the floor, you need to hear the rest of what I have to present. Information that will answer many of the questions you have already asked, but which will certainly raise more. Now, may I continue?
Glancing quickly around the table, Dr. Dubois encountered no objection. He rose from his chair, as if he could no longer bear the tension while remaining seated.
As I indicated in my early remarks, the testing conducted through late November produced a series of exciting results. However, during a test conducted on the morning of the last Friday in November, we noted an odd spike in measurements across the range of Atlas instruments. I'm talking about across the inner detector. The calorimeters, the muon spectrometer, even the outer toroid magnets. Even more disconcerting, the readings continued after the beam channel was shut down. Naturally, we first looked for some failure in the instrumentation, faults in the electronics or in the software responsible for collecting and processing the data.
Dr. Dubois' face had taken on a pallor that could not be blamed solely on the room lights. Roger understood why. The implications were enormous. For Atlas to record such a powerful event with no beam firing couldn't be good.
We shut down all further LHC testing until we could determine the exact nature of the problem. We have not done a beam firing since that day.
Wait 1 minute.
Dr. Gottlieb rose from his chair to point at the screen.
You said that image was collected this morning.
Dr. Dubois nodded.
That is correct. That is a slice of the data collected by the Atlas detector this morning.
But if there has been no proton acceleration around the LHC, how...
Dr. Gottlieb's question trailed off into horrified silence.
Jesus Christ.
The words slipped from Roger's lips like a prayer. It was worse than he had thought.
The November anomaly, as we have come to call it, appeared at the interaction point within Atlas and somehow achieved a semblance of stability. We immediately scrambled to isolate the anomaly in an intense electromagnetic containment field to keep it from escaping the vacuum chamber. Since that day, we have had a team of engineers working around the clock to improve the quality of the surrounding vacuum, adding multiple redundancies to prevent electromagnetic or vacuum failure.
Dr. Dubois pulled a handkerchief from his pocket, dabbing at the beads of sweat that dampened his brow.
I think you can see why we've held this information close hold, as the best minds on the program struggle to understand exactly what has happened.
But how is that possible?
Asked Dr. Boudreau. Admittedly, I'm an astrophysicist rather than a quantum specialist, but even the energies provided by LHC collisions have far too small a probability cross-section to allow for stable formation of some sort of micro-black hole. Besides, Hawking radiation should dissipate any black hole with a mass of less than 200,000 kilograms in under a second. A micro-black hole such as yours should have evaporated in a tiny fraction of that time.
We don't think that's what it is. You don't think?
Dr. Gottlieb sputtered. Roger realized that he had also risen to his feet, although he found himself leaning on the table for support.
And after 3 months of secret study, what have you learned?
Dr. Dubois started to speak, paused, then began again.
The anomaly violates all accepted theory. We have pored over every paper published in the last 50 years that could remotely have bearing on this matter, and have only found one that seems to describe what we are seeing. It's a theoretical treatise titled Quasi-Stable Quantum Singularities, published 3 years ago.
And what does the physicist who wrote the paper have to say about your anomaly? Roger pressed.
I don't know. We haven't spoken to him.
What? Why the hell not?
Dr. Craig bellowed.
Gentlemen, please sit back down. Thank you. I know you are all wondering why I have gathered you here instead of taking this directly to the world's governing bodies. What we have here is something entirely beyond our current understanding of physics. Something that, for now, appears quasi-stable. It has the potential to transform into something far more dangerous. Possibly even a black hole that would consume our planet. If a government reacted to this out of fear, you can imagine what they might try.
The table jumped as Dr. Craig's fist slammed its surface.
They'll nuke the bloody hell out of your goddamn science experiment. Should have been done before now.
Roger understood Dr. Craig's anger, but all he could do was lean back in his chair, too stunned to respond. Dr. Dubois leaned forward.
And if they do that, they will probably bring about the disaster that we all fear. According to our analysis of the equations in the paper I mentioned, an anomaly of this type occupies an inflection point between a number of more stable states, most of which are unpleasant. Even a relatively minor perturbation could tip it from its perch, sweeping away humanity in an avalanche of destruction. So we have determined that you four, as respected scientific representatives of the key governments of the European Union, Great Britain, and the United States, are best suited to bring this knowledge to your political leadership. After those governments have absorbed the facts, they can come to consensus on how best to proceed.
Dr. Craig's face had acquired a purple cast.
You still haven't answered my question. Why haven't you contacted the physicist who wrote the damned paper?
Because until now, we haven't been able to.
Dr. Dubois looked directly at Roger.
We'll need the help of the American government to reach him.
Roger inhaled softly. And why is that?
Because he's incarcerated in an American prison. The physicist to whom I refer is the famous Dr. Donald R. Stevenson.
Chapter 2. The foot caught Mark just below the solar plexus, knocking the wind from his body even as he twisted to avoid the blow. Pain exploded in his gut. But Mark channeled it, storing it away for later processing. Right now, he just needed to survive. A funny thought. Only moments earlier, Mark had been focused on winning this fight. Now, as blood and sweat blurred his vision and lack of breath sapped his strength, that goal seemed a distant dream. Jack the Ripper was taking him apart with an ease that defied belief. Marshaling all his neurally enhanced speed, Mark swung his body into a spinning sidekick that should have hurled his tormentor across the room. Instead, he felt himself lifted, propelled by his own momentum in a judo flip that slammed his back into the floor and sent white flashes dancing across his vision. Blinded and stunned, Mark whipped his legs around, somehow managing to land back on his feet and stay there, even though his knees felt like rubber.
Enough!
Jack's voice sounded distant, as if it came from one of those tin can and string telephones that he'd made with Heather and Jen when they were kids.
That's enough for this session.
Jack continued, stepping forward to slap him smartly on the back.
Good workout.
A small titter of laughter from across the room caused Mark to glance toward his sister.
Seriously, Mark?
Jin managed to get out between chortles.
There were a couple of times I thought you had him at your mercy.
Struggling to regain enough breath for a sharp retort, Mark finally abandoned the attempt.
That's okay, Jennifer,
Jack said.
Your turn.
As Mark stumbled to a seat beside Heather, he managed to smile. After suffering a major league ass-whipping, it was nice to have something to look forward to. The 10 weeks that Mark, Jennifer, and Heather had spent at the Fraser Hacienda had been the most difficult of their lives. Mark didn't know what he had expected, but this hadn't been it. Jack and Janet had immersed the three friends in a training program more intense than any imagined by the CIA. For 20 hours each day, they had oscillated between physical training, weapons training, martial arts training, and a variety of classroom work on the how-tos of clandestine operations. How to spot a tail. How to lose a tail. How and whom to bribe. How to establish a base of operations in continental Europe, the U.S., Britain, India, Pakistan, Africa, Russia, Latin America, China. How to blend into societies where you should stand out. How to purchase illegal weapons, documents, and equipment. And just when they thought it couldn't get any tougher, Jack ratcheted up the intensity. It was exciting, but it also kept Mark too busy and tired to worry much about other things, like what his parents must be going through. Even though Jack knew about the neural enhancements they had received on the Bandolier ship, he wanted to find out their limits. More than that, Mark knew that Jack wanted them to discover their limits. Even though Mark loved that they were learning things very few people would ever know, he felt as if they would have made a break for freedom if it hadn't been for the weekends. Sci-fi Saturdays and Sundays is what they'd come to call them. A sequence of Twilight Zone episodes driven by Jack's desire to learn everything about the Bandolier ship, its technologies, its agenda, and what it had done and was still doing to his three trainees. The lab sessions ranged from fascinating to downright spooky. Recently, Jack had them working in total darkness, letting their minds convert sound to images, a form of echolocation that produced imagery of their surroundings. The louder the noise, the brighter the resultant mental pictures. Luckily, Friday and Saturday nights had been reserved for rest and relaxation, local R&R, Janet called it. On those nights, they could almost be mistaken for a family. Jack and Janet taking them to San Javier to stroll through the town, to stop for dinner over some Bolivian beers, to laugh and talk. One thing Jack had said during their training sessions had imprinted itself on Mark's brain. "This world will try to beat you down. Only laughter can counteract that. Laughter is ammunition. Resupply often." Mark remembered the sound of Janet's throaty laughter echoing through the room at that remark, driving the point home. But since the birth of their baby Robbie 8 weeks ago, Jack had been their principal trainer. Even the childbirth had been incorporated into their training. Yashe, the indigenous midwife, had managed the delivery, assisted by Mark, Jennifer, and Heather. The intensity of the experience had branded its details into his mind's eye. Janet had endured an agonizing 18 hours of labor as Jack sat beside her, holding her hand and guiding her through a variation on Lama's breathing exercises. A credit to her self-discipline, Janet never whimpered or cried out, although the sweat beaded on her forehead, forming tiny rivulets that Jack wiped away with a damp cloth. As for Mark, Jen, and Heather, they had been kept busy doing whatever the Quechua midwife demanded. When the baby finally came, it had been Mark who assisted with cutting and tying off the umbilical cord. But not before a panicked few moments of wondering if the baby boy would start breathing. Although Mark had thought all new babies cried as a part of taking that first breath, this one hadn't made a sound. Only a sharp word from Yache had snapped him out of his frozen state and gotten him moving as she directed. By the time they had finished all the post-birthing tasks, the three young friends hadn't even bothered to eat, dragging themselves off to their rooms for rest and recovery, more bone-tired than at any other time in their training.
"Heather, you're up."
Jack's words brought Mark out of his reverie as Heather stepped forward and Jennifer stumbled onto the seat beside him, her breath coming in ragged gasps. Although she hadn't been bloodied, she was clearly teetering on the edge of muscle failure. Every Friday was evaluation day, during which Jack tested their mastery of the training they had received thus far. Mark knew one thing for certain. Never again would he think TGIF. Fridays flat out sucked. Suddenly, Mark's attention shifted to the center of the padded mat that covered the small gym's floor. One of Heather's punches had managed to penetrate Jack's defenses, her small fist striking his chin a grazing blow. As the two combatants shifted stance, Mark caught a glimpse of Heather's eyes. They'd turned milky white. Shit. She'd gone deep, fighting Jack in the now as her savant mind gazed into the future. Once again she lashed out, but this time Jack slipped the blow. For the briefest of moments, Mark thought Jack's eyes glinted red. Then, as Heather whirled into an axe kick, Jack chopped her sharply in the solar plexus, sending the air whooshing from her lungs in one great burst. Heather doubled over on the mat, then rolled on her side, simultaneously struggling to draw breath and rise to her feet, for the moment failing to do either. As Mark and Jennifer started to move, Jack's stern gaze sent them back to their seats. As he stood above Heather, watching her intently, Jack made no move to assist her. A month ago, Mark would have been unable to contain his anger. Now, it all made sense. For Jack to baby any one of them would be to dishonor that person. Before they'd started training, Jack and Janet had briefed them on the rigors of the program they would endure, and they had each consented. Too late now to back out. With a Herculean effort, Heather raised herself from the floor, once again moving into a ready position. "Excellent," Jack said. He motioned to Mark and Jennifer. "Everyone have a seat out here on the mat." As they complied, Jack walked to a corner closet, retrieved a box from the shelf, and then seated himself on the mat directly in front of Heather. "You have a unique ability," he said to her. "All of you share various talents as a result of the neural augmentation you received from the bandolier ship headbands, but your minds have their own natural strengths and preferences. Heather, I've watched you play chess. There's not a person in the world that can beat you. Certainly no computer can. You see all the possibilities and know what is most likely to happen from any setup. It's why you were able to hit me just now." Jack paused to remove a chess set from the box, setting it on the floor between them. Mark watched closely as Jack removed several pieces, arranging them into an end game in which each side had four pieces. White had its king trapped on the first row by the black rook, and black had its king similarly limited to movement on the eighth row. Black had another rook and pawn, while white had a queen and pawn remaining. Jack spun the board so that Heather played white. "What are the odds white wins?" he asked.
"Whose move?" Heather asked.
"White."
"Checkmate in one move."
"What are the odds of white winning?"
100%, Heather said.
"Show me."
Mark saw Heather glance at him and shrug, as if to say, "This is too easy."
"If you insist."
As she reached for the white queen, her hand accidentally touched the white pawn. Heather froze, then reached for the queen.
"You touched the pawn. By rule, you must move it."
Jack grinned.
"Accidental touches don't count."
"You touched the pawn and lingered. That counts as an intentional touch."
Heather frowned. Mark could tell she was confused about what had just happened. A winning move had just become a losing move. She had reached for the queen, but something had distracted her. Mark saw a light dawn as she swung toward her friend.
"Jennifer!"
Jack laughed.
"Before you get angry with Jennifer, I want you all to think about what just happened here. The most talented savant mind on the planet just calculated the odds of winning a simple chess endgame at 100%, an absolute certainty. But she lost. Why?
I prearranged for Jennifer to nudge Heather's subconscious when she least expected such interference, forcing her to accidentally bump the white pawn. I did it to teach you the most important lesson you'll ever get. Before I let you off early today, I want to burn this into your minds. Don't trust anyone. Not even your best friends. Love them, but never trust them completely. At critical times, they can be influenced to do things you don't want. Mark would throw away his life to save Heather, even though she'd hate him for it. Heather would do the same for him. In your own ways, you would all betray each other, just like Jennifer betrayed Heather in this little game.
Mark's face clouded.
Wait just a minute. Jennifer didn't betray her.
No, Jennifer said, giving Mark a thankful look. I didn't.
Oh, you had good reason, Jack continued. I manipulated you by telling you it was a critical part of the lesson I'm teaching, but you still betrayed her by making her lose. Given the right reasons, you would all do the same. Remember it. And remember this. No victory is certain. No situation is hopeless. When you find yourselves in a hopeless situation, change the rules. You mean cheat, Mark said. Jack grinned. Like the devil himself.
Chapter 3. President Leonard Jackson stared across the conference table at Dr. Roger Daubert, the scientist meeting his gaze with an unflinching calm that belied the nature of the briefing he had just presented. No one on the National Security Council spoke, an event almost as unusual as the subject of the briefing, but maybe it was a sign that they'd begun to get used to his leadership style. At least, that's how he chose to interpret it.
So, let me get this straight, President Jackson said. Dr. Stevenson rejected our request for his help in return for my commuting his sentence to time already served.
That is correct. He wants a full pardon, a public apology from you, as President of the United States, for the grievous errors that resulted in his imprisonment and full reinstatement of his security clearance. In addition, he wants to be appointed Special Scientific Envoy to CERN and to be placed in charge of the November Anomaly Project. The Secretary of State hissed, "Pretentious bastard!" President Jackson held up his hand to quiet the expressions of outrage that echoed around the table.
"There's one other thing," Dr. Daubert continued,
fanning out several pages filled with scribbled notes. "You may recall that on my initial visit to Dr. Stevenson's jail cell a week ago, I left him with a number of papers describing the measurements taken by the Atlas detector. At the end of my subsequent visit yesterday, after making all his demands, Dr. Stevenson handed me these pages filled with handwritten equations."
"And?"
the president asked. "And they are nothing short of incredible. I have run these by the top scientists on the Atlas program, and they were stunned. Given rudimentary information, and with only pencil and paper, Dr. Stevenson produced a mathematical model of the anomaly that is far more accurate than the project physicists have been able to generate using all their supercomputer simulations. And he did it in less than a week." The president leaned forward so that his palms pressed flat on the table.
"Are you going to tell us what the paper predicts?"
"The anomaly is gradually spiraling into instability." Dr. Daubert took a deep breath. "We have 9 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days until it reaches the tipping point."
"Which means?"
"Game over."
Chapter 4. His human eye lay dead in its socket alongside its artificial partner, the impenetrable darkness rendering both of them as useless as his missing lower extremities. But his nose still worked.
The stagnant air concentrated the stench around the freshly used camp toilet so powerfully he could taste it. Raoul tied the plastic baggie full of his steaming business and tossed it onto a heap of its mates, piled beside the non-operational disposal bin. If not for the huge stash of meals ready to eat, water, and supplies that Dr. Stevenson had stored in this secret section of the Rose Ship, Raoul would have perished long ago. Lord knew he had tried to kill himself, but the damned nanites that populated his bloodstream wouldn't permit it, repairing each self-inflicted wound almost as quickly as he had carved it into his flesh. And starvation was out of the question. The nanites required energy, and when they were denied food, they took fuel from his body tissue, using that energy to keep him alive. The process slowly depleted his body, but the nanite-augmented food and water cravings consumed him. Once Raoul realized he didn't possess the will to starve himself, he'd given up, resigning himself to this dark hell in which Dr. Stevenson had imprisoned him. But his busy mind refused to allow him to just lie there. Instead, he set about exploring every square centimeter of the large chamber by touch. Blindly pulling himself along, he felt his way along conduits and cables, and over every piece of alien equipment. Only a few months ago, with the power of his connection to the starship's neural network, every piece of this stuff had been as much a part of him as his own hands and arms. Now the ship was dead, drained of power during Stevenson's hijacking of Raoul's attempt to create a transitory gravitational gateway. Why had Stevenson done it? At first, Raoul had thought it was punishment for his challenge to Stevenson's authority. But that made no sense. Dr. Stevenson never did anything that didn't fit into some grand scheme. Yet what benefit could come from completely draining the Rose ship's power reserves? Raoul's mind fingered the questions like worry beads, sliding them back and forth in his brain until his head throbbed with a dull heat. If only he could access the ship's neural net, he could figure it out. Not a likely scenario. The last time he had felt a connection had been the moment he accessed the ship's maintenance protocol to shut down Stevenson's program. But he'd been just a moment too late. As the override kicked in, Raoul had felt his connection to the Rose ship die. Even if the maintenance protocol had succeeded in shutting down the pathways to the remaining power cells, it left Raoul no way to restore those channels. It wouldn't take much power to do it, but he didn't even have a watch battery. Just some cases of MREs, a few hundred gallons of distilled water, and a growing pile of festering shit bags. Festering shit bags. The thought caught in his fevered mind like an annoying song he couldn't get out of his head. Festering shit. Raoul stiffened. Methane gas. If he'd still had legs, Raoul would have kicked himself. He had wasted so much time wallowing in self-pity, and the dark-induced madness gnawing at his mind had made lucid moments a rarity. All the while, he had had potential power sources lying all around him. Not just methane, either. Every MRE came with its own flameless heating pouch. All he had to do was add water to the mixture of magnesium, dust, and salt, and in seconds it was hot enough to blister his hands. If he stuck the pouch back in the box along with the MRE, in 10 minutes he was rewarded with a hot meal. It was his one remaining luxury. The MREs also contained matches and paper, but the brief light the matches provided merely tormented his biological eye. The darkness was better than that. And even though his ship's life support system survived in some sort of minimal mode, he doubted it could deal with the smoke of a little campfire. The thought of coughing his lungs out while the nanites kept him alive provided all the incentive he needed to avoid that scenario. Raoul's brain roiled, churning the possibilities into a sloppy hope soup. He could generate heat. Electricity was another matter. For that,
he needed a rudimentary generator. For that, he needed magnets, wire, and a host of other parts. Tools wouldn't be a problem, not with the virtual machine shop Dr. Stevenson had created in here over his decades of trying to make basic repairs. And even though they'd been ignored after Raoul achieved his linkage with the Rose ship's neural net and gained control of the stasis field, those tools now gave him a lifeline. And though he couldn't access the neural net, that didn't mean he'd forgotten everything from his previous linkage. Raoul knew this ship well enough to figure out how to use those tools to make what he needed. It would just take time, and time was something he had in abundance.
Chapter 5 Janet's slender fingers slid along the back of Mark's neck, her delicate touch sending shivers of pleasure down his spine. His own hand responded, fingertips barely touching the hollow of her back. Lingering there, the nerves so alert that it seemed each contact produced tiny sparks from her skin to his, he felt her ear touch his, the scent of her bare throat filling his nostrils. Her body moved against his in perfect rhythm, the feel of her full breasts against his chest, robbing him of whatever self-control he still retained. Janet's skin shone with sweat in the dim light, and her breath came in small pants of exertion, barely audible above Mark's thundering heart. Her bare right leg encircled him, and her body swayed, as Mark's body writhed within her entangling limbs. Janet's back arched until only his right arm kept her from falling. Then, in a thunderous climactic crescendo, it ended. Hearing shouts of approval echo across the room, Mark raised his head to see Jennifer and Heather applauding vigorously. Even Jack nodded his appreciation.
"Now that's how the tango is supposed to be danced."
"Wonderfully done," Janet said as Mark pulled her back to her feet. Turning to Jennifer and Heather, she continued, "You've practiced these dances many times. Now I want you to play that dance back in those perfect little memories of yours. Then, one at a time, I will call you up. I want each of you to dance with Mark, exactly as I did."
"With Mark?"
Jennifer sputtered.
"Exactly as I did," Janet continued. "Everything we do here has a purpose. We've been teaching you all the Latin and classical ballroom dances because if you can dance them with abandon, you can dance anything. In the world of which you are now a part, dancing will open a surprising number of doors for you. But first, you must look like you're having fun, and you must be convincing. People should see you dance and wish they were your partner."
Janet cast a wicked smile at Mark that made him look away.
"Just now, I believe you were having fun. I want you to repeat that with Jennifer, then Heather, and I better not notice any difference, or it's going to be a very, very long night."
Chapter 6
Jennifer sat on the grass, flanked by Mark and Heather, watching the glorious sunset paint the western sky in steadily darkening shades of magenta and purple. Less than 100 yards up the hill behind them, Janet played with Robbie as Jack leaned over the smoking barbecue grill.
"I'm worried about Mom and Dad,"
Jennifer surprised herself by saying what she'd been thinking. Beside her, Heather tensed.
"I know. It's driving me crazy. I've been so homesick. But for them, not to know we're even alive, it gives me nightmares."
Mark glanced over his shoulder, a quick look to see if Jack and Janet remained out of earshot.
"We always talk about it, but we never do anything."
"Jack told us not to," Heather replied.
"We never should have asked him," Jennifer said. "We knew what he'd say. He's right, you know."
"I don't. Not anymore."
"Me either," said Mark. "It's been too long."
Jennifer felt a lump rise in her throat, leaving her voice husky.
I'm just so scared. If we do it, hack our way onto their laptops, leave them a message, it might get them killed. It might give away our location.
And if we don't?
That scares me too.
Jennifer wiped a tear from her cheek.
How long can they go on not knowing we're okay?
Lately, images of her mom sobbing inconsolably had begun crawling through her mind. A shrill whistle from the direction of the house cut off the conversation.
Guess dinner's ready, Mark said, rising to his feet.
Don't let Jack see you crying.
Wasn't planning to.
As they walked up the hill toward the waiting dinner, Jennifer pulled forth the required memories, letting her mask settle in place. As hard as it was, the decision could be put off for a while longer. In the meantime, they'd gut it out and be the people Jack and Janet expected them to be. Chapter 7. A curly wisp of smoke wafted up from the table. An acrid odor emanated from the soldering iron and irritated Heather's nose, causing it to crinkle as she sniffed away the oncoming sneeze.
Waiting on you, Mark.
Jennifer's jibe barely registered, though, as Mark remained focused on bridging the last delicate trace. Setting the iron back in its spring stand, Mark leaned over and snapped the plastic cover in place.
That's it.
He reached across the laptop, plugging the dongle into the forward USB port.
It hasn't cooled, Jennifer said. You'll break it.
Trust me.
You said that last week, Heather said, although she had considerably more faith in his electrical craftsmanship than her comment indicated. Mark snorted.
Power spike. Not my fault.
Heather laughed. Okay, okay. Let's just finish this off and test it. Despite the banter, she could see Mark was excited. They all were. If this worked, it marked a revolution in the capabilities of their computer lab, intelligence center, or whatever they chose to call the thatch-roofed outbuilding that housed the Fraser Computer and Communications Complex. They had already modified the circuit boards and all the laptops to add built-in subspace receiver transmitters, but this would enable them to add subspace communications capabilities to any computer just by plugging in a small USB device. Heather let her gaze wander the room, pausing at the sealed door leading into the adjacent clean room. It represented the culmination of their efforts these last 3 months. Still, as amazing as their electronics work had become, it only formed a part of Jack's sci-fi weekends, the other part being their ongoing headset exploration of their starship's databanks. When they'd arrived at the Fraser Hacienda, it had been mid-January, Bolivian summer. They hadn't recognized the pressure cooker in which they were about to be immersed. To be fair, Jack and Janet had clearly laid out the training program, and Mark, Jen, and Heather had all volunteered. Knowing what she knew now, she would still have done it. Just not with the same degree of enthusiasm. She still missed her parents, and worried about them constantly. Only fear that contact would place them in danger had prevented communication. That and the fact that Jack had strictly forbidden it. But Heather's visions had taken on a darker tone of late, bringing her to the brink of a decision that could knock Mark, Jen, and herself from this perch they had worked so hard to attain. Had it been any other topic, she would have consulted Jack and Janet. But not this. It was too important, too personal. Mark and Jennifer were the only ones she would divulge her fears to. But not yet. Not while hope remained.
Hello? Anyone home in there? Mark nudged her.
What? Oh, sorry. Lost in thought.
Let's fire it up.
Jennifer opened the laptop, took a deep breath, and pressed the power button. The Windows logo replaced the black-and-white BIOS screen. From her position behind and to the right of Jennifer, Heather found the 7,204 RPM drive noise disconcerting.
Still, 0.06% variance from the drive spec was well within tolerance. Nothing to worry about. Though Heather succeeded in banishing the small worry from her thoughts, her mind replaced it with another. Would the USB oscillating circuit deliver the required performance? It would if the printed circuit-thin film resistors performed within tolerance. Christ. Chinese components.
"So far, so good," Jen said. "Now let's see if our super Wi-Fi dongle works."
Mark cracked his knuckles.
"After all that effort, it better."
"It will."
Heather hoped she sounded more confident than she felt. A probability of 73.65847% was far from a certainty. Jen began rattling off the steps from her mental checklist.
"Entering coordinate, identifying available networks, selecting network, sniffing packets, verified, inserting TCP packets, verifying responses."
Heather found herself grinning, even as Jennifer thrust her hands into the air.
"Yes!"
Smacking Mark's hand in a quick series of high fives, Heather finally released the breath she'd been holding. Mark leaned down for a closer look at the display.
"You know what this means? Our bag of tricks just got a hell of a lot lighter."
"Plug and play."
Mark placed his hand on Jen's left shoulder.
"It's dinner time. Let's shut it down. We've got a long night ahead."
The vision tugged at the mind curtain Heather closed to block it. Mark had no idea how right he was.
Chapter 8. "Are you ready for this?"
Jack's voice held an edge nobody without the neural augmentations Heather, Mark, and Jen enjoyed could have detected.
"Why shouldn't we be?" Mark replied. "We've been linking with the Bandolier ship headsets every week."
"True. But up until now, you've only browsed the ship's unprotected data banks. Today, I'm going to ask more of you."
"Such as?"
Jack turned away to stare out the window that filled most of the living room's western wall. For perhaps a minute, he remained perfectly still, his lithe form silhouetted against the sunlit hills that rolled away from the ranch house to the horizon. When he turned once more to face them, his face formed an unreadable mask.
"Fair enough. It's time Janet and I made you aware of our concerns."
He pointed toward the comfortable chairs and couches arranged around the low coffee table. Heather sat down, as did Mark and Jen. For some time now, she'd been expecting this talk. She'd seen it coming in her visions, different versions, but always the same topic. Suspicious thoughts hovered around Jack and Janet like ghostly halos whenever they mentioned the Bandolier ship or the four alien headsets. As if on cue, Janet entered from the kitchen, paused to set little Robbie in the baby rocker, winding the handle several times and setting it in motion before sliding onto the love seat. Jack settled in beside her. Heather glanced at the baby. Robbie already bore a striking resemblance to his father, especially in the eyes. But there was something else about the child that both fascinated and unnerved her. For one thing, the little boy never cried. Whenever Heather looked into those eyes, the feeling he was studying her rose within, as though she were a zoo animal on the far side of safety glass. Heather knew it was ridiculous to think this way about a 3-month-old, but as she looked into those eyes, she couldn't shake the feeling. Jack's voice brought her out of her reverie.
"Throughout your training here, we've made it clear that everything we have you do is voluntary. And although you've done everything Janet and I have asked of you, you can't have helped noticing a certain amount of distrust on our part. It's time for you to know just how strong that distrust is."
Having Jack say aloud what she'd long suspected slapped Heather in the face, as if he'd struck her with his open hand. From the silence that hung in the air, she knew Mark and Jennifer felt the shock just as strongly. For several long moments, Jack let it hang there, allowing his words to achieve their full emotional impact.
Don't get me wrong. You're the finest group of young people I've ever known. What Janet and I don't trust is the agenda of the starship that altered you.
Wait just a second, Jen burst out. The Rose ship's the bad one.
Damn right, Mark agreed. And it's not like the starship chose us. It was just pure dumb luck that we stumbled onto it and tried on the headsets.
Was it? Janet asked. You know the odds that the wind catches your model plane and drops it down that canyon right into the starship cavern? 2,423,851.
The words tumbled from Heather's lips before she caught herself. A smile lit Janet's beautiful face.
Pretty slim odds.
Mark shrugged.
Shit happens.
True, said Jack. But this might not be one of those times. Remember when I told you not to trust anyone completely, not even each other? Think about the agendas in play here. You've seen what your starship wanted to show you about its enemies. That doesn't mean your bandolier ship has Earth's best interests at heart. We think it's trying to stop whatever the creators of the Rose ship had in mind, but we don't really know the bandolier ship's original mission.
Janet shifted to face Mark across the table.
And we don't know why you were each drawn to a particular headset. Although all of you have been enhanced across the board, you each have special skills that are significantly different. Does that mean the headsets have certain crew positions to fill on the ship? Heather's ability to calculate probable outcomes and evaluate strategies implies a command function. Mark, your physical and language enhancements would seem to fill a security officer role, while Jen's computer expertise and ability to influence the thoughts of others could fill a communications and science officer function. We also know that once a headset attunes with someone, nobody else can use it while the original user still lives.
Heather shook her head.
I've considered all that. Too many holes in the logic. What about the fourth headset? As far as we know, only two people have attuned with it. The Ragman and El Chupacabra. Hardly starship crew candidates.
But with similar natures, said Jack.
Jennifer shook her head.
Ridiculous. A homicidal maniac crew position?
Janet reached out, letting her fingers brush Robbie's curly brown hair as he rocked slowly back and forth.
It's more common than you imagine. In the Soviet Union, it was standard procedure to place a political officer with every unit to ensure loyalty to the motherland. The Nazis used the Gestapo in a similar role. In Saudi Arabia, a volunteer clerical police force called the Mutawa'a enforced Sharia law. Throughout the Middle East, religious police perform similar functions throughout society.
But not in Western governments, Mark said.
Don't kid yourself. Even the U.S. has its enforcers of politically correct thought, whether they are internal security, internal affairs, internal revenue, or even some of the media. Their mission is to make people toe the line. They wield special powers that inspire fear.
It doesn't make them the ragman, Heather interjected.
No, but they'll do whatever it takes to force people to conform. That kind of power attracts zealots and fanatics.
So you think we're under some sort of alien influence?
Heather asked.
Jack shook his head. If I thought that, I wouldn't be training you. But we need to know everything we can about the intentions of both ships' creators. We also need to learn everything we can about their technology. You've already done amazing work in this area, but we need to delve deeper. How do their weapons work? Not just the starship weapons, but personal weapons as well. What other technologies are hidden away? In the case of your bandolier ship, we have an in, the headsets. But that means you're going to have to breach the ship's internal security mechanisms and get access to the restricted parts of its computing systems.
You think I haven't tried? Jen asked. Those systems are interwoven with complex fractal patterns that I haven't even come close to cracking.
You'll need to work together. While you have the headsets on, you're all linked to the ship and to each other.
You share imagery, even thoughts. By focusing your combined talents on cracking one barrier at a time, you'll have a chance. Heather exchanged fleeting glances with Mark and Jennifer before responding. The ship isn't stupid. Its computing systems function as a fully integrated expert system, possibly even an AI. It's bound to have defenses against what we'll be trying. Some of those might not be as passive as firewalls and encryption. It may lock us out completely, or worse.
Jack nodded. There is that risk. It's why Janet and I have had you exploring the other systems through your headsets these last few weeks, letting you enhance your familiarity with the ship's artificial intelligence in a non-aggressive manner. It's why you'll need to proceed with extreme caution. Jennifer's skill guided by your mind and by Mark's link to the security systems. I'm counting on you to find a path through those defenses.
Mark inhaled deeply, cracking his knuckles as he breathed out.
Sounds interesting. I'm game.
Me too,
added Jennifer. Feeling all eyes on her, Heather centered, thrusting aside a series of disconcerting visions that sought to pull her into the deep.
Let's do it.
Chapter 9. After dinner, Heather took her turn cleaning dishes before walking through the open alcove onto the veranda. It was a beautiful fall evening, temperature hovering in the high 70s with just enough breeze to make the humidity comfortable. Although Sunday was usually the day set aside for their headset exploration of the Bandolier starship, Jack had decided it was time to change up the routine. Even though the headsets worked through a subspace link that was undetectable by earthly technology, and Dr. Stevenson was rotting in an American prison cell, predictable patterns of behavior violated Jack's sense of security. But Heather detected something else in Jack's demeanor, an eagerness she had never before observed. Slipping into a wicker chair, Heather inclined her head toward Mark and Jen, each occupying a similar chair, all three arranged around a low wrought iron table. In the center of the table, an open aluminum case held the four alien headbands, the area dimly illuminated by an oil hurricane lamp that hung suspended from a support beam. Jack leaned against the wall, his eyes studying the full moon that shed almost as much light as the lamp itself. The scene reminded Heather of a seance more than a serious scientific experiment. But then, in a strange way, maybe that's what it was.
You ready?
Jack asked, his strange eyes locking with hers.
Yes.
Good.
Jack pulled up a wooden stool, seating himself where he could see the faces of all three of his trainees.
Because tonight, you're going up against the artificial intelligence controlling the Bandolier ship. Your mission is to gain access to the ship's restricted data banks. In order to make that happen, you'll have to convince the ship's artificial intelligence that you are truly the crew and not just candidates that have attuned to the headsets.
And how do we do that? Jennifer asked.
That's something you'll have to figure out together once you're all linked in. Don't rush it. Heather's intuition should guide you, but she won't be able to do it alone. The ship must fully accept you all.
And if something goes wrong? Mark asked.
I'll be here watching you. If I think you're in trouble, I'll remove the headsets. But remember, you have to retain control of your own minds. Don't lose your way back.
Heather reached for the metal case. The four headsets lay nestled in its dark foam padded interior, each exactly like its mates. The strange metal picking up the dancing lamplight, so photons seemed to bead up and crawl along its surface. Wasn't it odd how her hand was drawn only to the one she recognized as her own? Lifting the light band from its resting place, Heather leaned back, letting Jennifer and Mark select their own. Then, as their eyes met, they all slid the bands up over their temples. As the small nubs at the ends of Heather's headband touched her head, they elongated, the massaging pulse spreading through her body as each sought its optimum position.
Then, the world dissolved. She was on the starship, her virtual self standing on the command deck, its smoothly curved walls, ceiling, and floor as beautiful as she remembered. Glancing to her right and left, she saw Jennifer and Mark settle into their crew couches, the translucent material flowing around them to cushion their bodies, as if they were preparing for takeoff. Jennifer had been the first to discover this unique capability, available to wearers of the starship's headbands. Something they had come to call the avatar projection. If they imagined themselves physically on the starship, the interaction between the ship's computer and their own enhanced minds created the impression that they were physically there. It was an illusion, but it sure as hell felt real. Far more real than a dream. So real that she could reach out and touch things, including Mark and Jennifer. While they were in the avatar projection, all their senses worked. Not just when they were roaming the ship, either. From the first summer they'd spent exploring their bandolier ship, they'd known how to have it surround them with sights and sounds of other places and scenes, like Bora Bora or the starship's arrival in this solar system. But now, when